This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 19th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 276 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
Coming up on today's programme, we hear from an award-winning photographer who's put life in Chechnya under the lens.
Plus,
after the chemo of hospital, he couldn't speak. He had no certainty about his memories or his studio or his music or anything. Everything was uncertain.
We meet the directors of an incredible new film about musician Edwin Collins and his journey of rediscovery and recovery following a stroke.
And we enter the world of the wealthy as we hear about a new book exploring the rise and rise of the world's rich over the past two millennia.
It goes back to this Carnegie Gospel of Wealth Darwinian notion. I became rich because I have special genes and special brains, and so therefore, just as I know better than most how to make money, so I know better than most how to spend that money.
That's the writer and broadcaster John Kampfner, and that is all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, what a week it was, Tom.
It was indeed, Rob. Can I just give you a couple of my highlights quickly?
Yes.
I wonder if they're the same as yours. On Tuesday and Wednesday evening, I was at Freeze London, and then the next day, Freeze Masters.
That was good, wasn't it? That's what we call classic art world bands.
There was top bands. Our radio shows, Midori House, those 2 days. In fact, weekly listeners will probably be quite intrigued to head to the relevant pages at monocle.com and listen to those shows again.
I would lead people up the garden path back to the future. To Midori, or was it when? Yeah, this Tuesday and Wednesday, we set up our radio booth, as you said, at Freeze London and at Freeze Masters. We had great guests. We had some pre-recorded bits and bobs. We had some sort of silliness. We can't take these things too seriously.
Yeah, a bit of japes. What about a highlight though? I wonder, because you know, it always intrigues me, especially Freeze with the whole two fares for the price of one thing.
Yeah.
What was a highlight? Was it found under the awnings of one in particular? Would you say? For you personally, Rob.
I love what they've done to Freeze Contemporary or Freeze London. I think they've really refreshed it. I think it's amazing. I think it is a place to discover rather than just be hammered over the head by lots of famous, you know, blue chip artists. I think it was cool. I thought the focus section was really nice. Nice to see our buddies at the Limoncello Gallery doing another really lovely witty show. There was a bar in a nuclear fallout bunker. I think that was Dan Gunn's gallery in Berlin. There were lots of very cool things. And Gagosian, you know, that cast and Holler thing right at the front of Freeze London was amazing. And of course, we tend to, you know, rather stupidly be a bit snobbish about what Larry Gagosian puts on his stand because we think we're going to know what it is every time he sets up his shop at an art fair. That was really surprising and really playful and really cool. I don't know how you get that work home because it was obviously the size of a house.
Hefty.
A hefty thing.
I guess you've got a very, very big house, Rob. That's
unless you have. And then the other, and talking of houses, the other thing I would absolutely love to take away if I had anywhere to put it, and I wonder who will buy it and where it will sit, because it also, I would hope it stays together, was Heli Narmad's stand at Freeze Masters, which was the sort of elephant in the room, as we were talking about earlier in the week, Tom, which is this amazing thing called The Collector, which he put together. Norman Rosenthal wrote an amazing essay about this fictional collector, and Heli Narmad presented his booth as this collector's fictional house, complete with Miro's, Lucio Fontana's, cigarettes in the ashtrays, dirty dishes in the kitchen sink. It was absolutely stunning, wasn't it?
It was pretty amazing stuff.
So, yeah, it was all right.
Yeah, well, seen one masterwork you've seen and all. I thought you were going to mention your stone cat.
I love him so much. This is a 12th century capital, which is like, it's sort of a bit like, it's not a gargoyle, a capital is something that goes even higher near the top of a church, I think. It was, I guess, liberated from a Norman French church, 12th century. Sam Fogg was selling it on his stand, and he did sell it. It was about 40 grand, I think, which was amazing. So maybe Robert Bounds' wheelbarrow of art maybe I need to do a bit of saving my pennies before I do the supermarket sweep at Freeze Masters. It was great having Victoria Siddle on. She is the director of Freeze Masters. She'll be taking over the directorship of both fairs as Matthew Slotover and Amanda Sharp sort of move on to pastures. They're still going to be involved. They're still going to be executive directors, whatever, but they're moving on to sort of pastures new and having a look at their deck of cards and seeing where they might go next. But I love Freeze Week. It's great. It's exhausting.
You look, but I've got to say, you look pretty fresh-faced, I've got to say, after a week of punishment.
Well, that's I always like to do the Monocle Weekly in the dark.
oh, dear, Rob, what are you like? well, I tell you what we should do next. Now, obviously, quite often I will gaze into my crystal ball with news and see what's happening in the week ahead. I can't do it because I'm in this chair. I'm on the other side of the table.
Yeah.
So we need to cast our net further. Literally in this case, because we're going all the way to the other side of the world next.
Are we going to Japan?
I think we are.
What man are we going to find there?
We, Stevie Bloomfield.
Ah.
Well, we continue on the weekly with a look into the big news stories of the next 7 days. Monocle's Steve Bloomfield is the man for that task this week, and he joins us not here in Studio One, Rob, no.
Oh, no.
He's much further afield than that.
Where's he jetted off to? Has he gone on the Jubilee line, the Piccadilly line, the Central line?
It's further even than that.
I can't fathom it.
I know, it's hard to imagine. But it's Tokyo, and he's in our brand newly opened bureau. Steve Bloomfield, welcome.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Rob. Speaking to you from the wonderful new Tokyo Monocle Bureau.
Does it smell? Has it got a sort of new car smell? Talk us through the vibe.
It has. It's funny that the studio bit, which is right at the back of the office, it's like a long bench with windows on either side. So right now I'm looking out onto the lovely little meeting room. There's a big window in front of me.
It does sound like a train carriage, actually.
It does a little bit. I can see Akio, our fashion director, with a whole row upon row of different clothes. He's just going through them, working out what we're going to pick out for the next shoot.
Very exciting. Well, tell us about some things that are happening next week, Steve. I guess where you are and maybe further afield all around the globe. I don't know where you're going to go this week.
We're going to go all over. There will be a bit of Tokyo. There's going to be a bit of Portland as well. But first of all, let's start with something which, let's face it, if you would have heard of this a week ago, you would have thought, well, that's not very interesting. Who wants to know where the Albanian Prime Minister is going next week? But
how wrong we are.
When the Albanian Prime Minister, Edi Rama, is about to visit Serbia, and Albania and Serbia have just had a football match.
They had that football match, didn't they?
Abandoned after a drone dropped a greater Albania flag on the pitch, causing riots, then actually the Albanian Prime Minister's visit to Serbia might be a little bit tasty.
As a referee, the man in the black shirt running around with a whistle, Steve, what's your take on this?
Well, I think it's fair to say that there is a little bit of bad blood between Serbia and Albania. Obviously, the issue of Kosovo is going to be at the top of the list. This whole meeting was supposed to be about the two sides coming together, trying to ensure that there were some sort of diplomatic avenues. Would Serbia one day recognise Kosovo and allow them into the European Union? Would Serbia and Albania become, you know, good friends? Which is perhaps always going to be a bit difficult.
A long shot.
But the fact that a bit of a long shot. But after this week's football match, where oddly the brother of the Prime Minister, a man called Orfi Rama, was accused by the Serbs of being the man with the drone controls. So how this is going to play out, I've no idea, but definitely one to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. What else should we be watching out for then, Steve, in the next 7 days?
Well, I've got one for you, Tom, but first, this one's for you, Rob.
Okay.
It's the 27th annual Tokyo International Film Festival.
Oh, nice.
That's taking place. It begins on Thursday. Are you a fan of the TIFF?
The TIFF, yeah. There's two TIFFs, aren't there? There's the Toronto.
There's two TIFFs. There's the Toronto TIFF.
And there's the Tokyo. I know where I'd rather be sent on an assignment, put it that way, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's various international guests. John Lasseter will be there. Tim Burton will also be here. And then a few Japanese stars, Takeshi Kitano, will be there. There's going to be the world premiere of Parasite, which is a live-action adaptation of a Japanese manga. How does that sound?
Oh, wow. That sounds tricky enough to be intriguing, right? I love the idea
it
of
does,
that.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. And what's the vibe? I wonder if you get the feeling in reading the newspapers and watching the TV and stuff, Steve, that it kind of takes over Tokyo, or if it's quite nichey, the film festival there.
Still a little bit nichey. I mean, one of the areas that's centred around is actually where our office is, Shibuya. So right round here, it's going to be a little bit more lively, one imagines. But, you know, when these festivals are in, I mean, I think just like the London Film Festival, when it's in a festival of, you know, in London, 9 million, here, 13 million, it's quite hard for something to really take over.
Exciting stuff. You said you had something for me, Steve. What is it?
Yeah. Okay, you'll like this as a hirsute fella. It's the World Beard and Moustache Championships.
Oh, that is a staple.
Yes.
That's very nice, isn't it?
It is. They're taking place in Portland, Oregon. I mean, where else? I mean,
home of the contemporary beard.
Totally.
I guess the only other place you could really have it is Hackney in East London.
Yeah.
I guess those two battle it out for who's going to host it.
What's your favourite category, Steve? Because there's quite a few, aren't there?
There are. I mean, I'm just looking at some of the pictures of the moustaches. They are quite astonishing. There is a wonderful handlebar here, which seems to, you know, go all the way sort of round and up to the ears. But they've got all sorts of people will be there, sort of past champions. There's moustaches, there's partial beards, and there's full beards. Those are three big divisions. Do you want to know some of the options for the partial beards?
Yeah.
I think we better learn.
Okay. You can have a natural. So, you know, right. It's just your classic goatee. Imperial, which is that big old handlebar.
WG Grace.
But it's still a partial beard, so not really the whole thing.
Is there a partial beard, no moustache?
It's a big moustache, and if I look closely at this picture, sort of a tiny little bit of a goatee. They describe it as slender with long tips, straight up or arching up. The hairs are only allowed to start growing up to the end of the upper lip. AIDS are allowed. So there we are.
What does that mean?
Musketeer?
It's making me feel itchy.
No idea. Do you want a musketeer? That's long and slender, and of course, there's the Amish beard.
Yeah, I mean, what is this? You're reading out the instructions for a dildo catalog.
What, long and slender or Amish beard?
And they call this the musketeer.
there's also the freestyle partial beard, which is, you know, if it doesn't really match. You can do what you want, really. I think, freestyle.
Steve, I feel like we should move on from this before it gets even worse.
I'm afraid we can't move on. That's it.
That was a pretty good roundup, Steve. Thank you very much. I look forward to your entry because you're in Tokyo for a few more days, so presumably you'll have a slender, what was it? A slender musketeer by the time you come back.
A 12-inch two-speed. I think... I think by the time you come back, Steve, you should just have gone seriously Merv Hughes on us and got a mega sort of thick, sort of like a badly trained caterpillar over your top lip. That's what we
Okay,
want.
I will do my best, and we'll see that by the time I return whether I can be entered into the World Beard and Moustache Championships.
Nicely.
Wonderful stuff. We'll look out for that. That's our Steve Bloomfield in our Tokyo Bureau, shedding some light on the big news stories of next week. With myself and Rob up next, we'll be talking to a photographer who's been, he's got a big new show in London. He's going to tell us all about it right after this.
The Republic of Chechnya is a territory shaped by years of conflict between Russian forces and local separatists, but its predicament is one often left uncovered by the world's media, and the daily lives of its citizens go relatively undocumented.
But a new exhibition at London's Saatchi Gallery throws Chechen life into the spotlight. Through winning the fourth edition of the Carmignac Gestion Photojournalism Award, Italian photojournalist Davide Monteleone was funded to work in Chechnya between December 2012 and April 2013. The resulting images illuminate the social, political and economic realities of life in Chechnya, and the show is called Spasibo. Davide, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Thanks very much for joining us. Tell us, first of all, before we talk about the pictures, about the name of the exhibition. Why is it called Spasibo? Tell us about that.
So the title is actually a sarcastical title, because the first things that you can see when you arrive in the main square in Grozny is actually a sign which say Ramzan Spasiba za Grozny, which in Russian means Ramzan, the president, thank you for Grozny. So eventually it's pretty clear that he put this sign himself. It's a weird situation. So, and I was also thinking why the Chechens should be thankful for a decade of war, because they have a town which has been rebuilt after being bombed, et cetera.
And I wanted to ask you, David, about the range of pictures. Obviously, you're a documentary photographer. It's being displayed here in London at the Saatchi Gallery.
Yeah.
Whether those two sort of disciplines veer off from each other. I mean, these are beautiful photographs, but they're documents of some pretty harsh places and some sort of grey and gritty places. Did you find beauty in this sort of slight grimness?
Well, definitely I did find beauty. I mean, it's an interesting country. It's a beautiful country in terms of landscape, mountains, but also in terms of people. I mean, there's a lot of really nice people. There's something which is always a mistake. When I was in Russia, there's a lot of Russian that were afraid of Chechnya. I mean, but this is also a sort of practice of terror to make people fear about something. So they start being scared, but in fact, it's a beautiful place. And also this idea of boundary between documentary photography and fine art photography, I think it doesn't really exist anymore. And this is, I think, is an evidence because actually those photojournalistic pictures, they found a place in Saatchi, which is not definitely considered like a documentary gallery.
It's not a newsroom, is it? But that's the thing. It's that interesting thing where people's understanding of Chechnya, as you said, you know, that Russians are scared of just the word. It's kind of become a folklore word almost about scariness. How easy was it to actually work there as a photographer?
Well, I think it was easy for me because I've been there many times. I was there like in 2003 for the first time, then 2007, then 2009, and then finally this time. There's always a problem with authorities. I mean, but this is part of the tradition of Russian before the Soviet Union, the sort of suspicious for journalists, photographers, foreigners in general. But I mean, so as long as I was dealing with normal people, it was no problem at all. But with the authorities, as soon as I was touching like some sensitive subject like human rights, tortures, kidnapping that used to happen in Chechnya before, then it was a little bit more complicated. But I found a good excuse. Actually, I was doing a story, I was doing a story about identity in Chechnya, which means a little bit of everything. So for authority, it was fine. I mean, what is identity? It's difficult to describe, and it's good for everyone.
That was the word on your lips, more than spasiba yes. for your time in Chechnya.
David, I wondered, how did your relationship with the subjects that you shoot change as you return to a country like Chechnya? Did you find that it was more difficult to be objective? And perhaps, you know, if you're taking pictures of people, did you find that you sort of felt a certain sympathy for a certain attitude? Did you find that that influenced the way you were even framing your pictures? Or did you find it quite easy to retain that sort of clinical photographer's eye?
Well, I think there's always a sympathy when you take pictures. I mean, as soon as you try to describe something, there's a part of personality that you have that comes out, whatever is a pictures or writing. In this specific job, and generally, I'm always trying to have a sort of neutral point of view, which doesn't mean that there's no interaction with the subject, but I try to give you an idea, a supernatural, and then you have to find the details in the pictures. So to try to discover, it's a sort of, you know, journey. You go inside the pictures, there's a gate, and then you found the story.
There's a lot of opposites, a lot of conflicting things in your pictures. There's a lot of juxtaposition, which obviously photographers kind of love to tell this thing. One picture tells the story of a city or all the rest of it. Did you have to search that out? I mean, is this pure documentary photography? Is it you documenting what you saw on the streets and in the houses of Chechnya? Or did you have to corral people sometimes into your images?
Well, again, I mean, this idea of documentary photography as a meaning, because photography was somehow invented to be like a way to record documents. But documentary photography is not the true. It's not the reality. It's always an interpretation. So in this respect, I played a little bit with photography, with the medium, and with the situation in Chechnya, which is a little bit ambiguous. And at the same time, photography is ambiguous as well. So you have these appealing that is a documentary pictures, and it is, but it doesn't mean it's the true, it's the reality.
One of the standout images is a 14-year-old girl in a wedding dress called Rada, who looks like she's a very young girl about to get married.
Yeah.
But this is presumably precisely what you're talking about. It looks like a documentary photograph, but there is a story behind it, which isn't. It's not just skin deep or dress deep, is it?
Well, actually, she's not getting married. She's just trying on a dress in a bus, by the way.
That's nice too. It's a strange background.
Well, but this is actually the beauty of photography. And in this specific project, it was used and was probably I abused of this ability of photography to be ambiguous, to be not completely clear. I mean, photography doesn't give you an evidence, doesn't testify something specifically, but is a way to propose a problem. But the answer is somewhere else, maybe.
Can I ask you about that then, in terms of the sort of the purpose of your work, perhaps? I mean, do you find that when you have an exhibition like this that's dealing with a subject like Chechnya, which is so complex, there's such strong views from all different sides, do you have an objective, if you like, for what you hope the exhibition will achieve, or do you not tend to look at it in those sorts of terms? Is it just simply more of an aesthetic exercise almost?
No, it's not, definitely it's not only an aesthetic exercise, and it's not objective. I mean, I have an opinion. I know what's the problem in Chechnya. There's a lot of troubles in Chechnya, but the truth is never in this side or that side is never black and white, so you have to be gray. And that's actually where my work goes from. But it's complicated, but it's fascinating part of photography. I mean, you just give a clue, and then, especially nowadays, there's the possibility to get information everywhere. I mean, you have internet, Facebook, whatever, social network. So if you are interested in Chechnya, you can go and look for. But the question is why you should search for Chechnya. And maybe the reason is because you have seen an exhibition at Saatchi Gallery. The goal of my work is actually to try to make people curious about the subject. And then they can go on their own and they just can search for information, for stories, for whatever is behind the pictures or and even more. Surely I will not be able to do an encyclopedia of Chechnya, whatever, Russia. You just give a glimpse of something then.
And that note, how didactic or how definite do you want the curatorial notes that accompany your show to be? Because this is always an important thing, the wall of text at the beginning of an exhibition or a show, and then, you know, whether it just simply says the name of the photograph and where it was taken and the date. I mean, I wonder how detailed you are with that.
Yeah, Well, this exhibition, first of all, he's been in Paris before, in Arles, in Milan, in Frankfurt. So this in such is the last stage of the tour that the exhibition is doing with the Carmignac Foundation. And of course, this location is different. So it's you have to be adapted every time to the specific location. One of the choices that I made is not to have caption on the wall. And the idea is actually that you have to participate to the pictures. So you see the pictures, you see the images, you enjoy the aesthetic, and then you try to get a sense out of the pictures. But at the same time, you have a text. So to confirm that what you have seen is what you think, or the other way around, or to start having more information. But definitely one of the things of photography and the show that I like to do is like, I just want to bring you into a journey, but you have to make your own journey, your own destination. This is also why it doesn't make any sense sometime to try to make a sequence in the exhibition, because you put these pictures on the right because you think it will be the first one, but then the audience will go left. So it's part of democracy and freedom.
You're right. And you mentioned the word identity when you were trying to get past some of the authorities and saying, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Is there a picture in the show that you think defines Chechen identity right now?
No, I think it's the complexity of the work that make the identity potentially. But I decided to do this because actually, while I was doing this work, I don't know if you remember, there was the bomb attack in Boston. And eventually was intrigued by the idea of this guy. They were Chechen, they were called Chechen, but actually they were raised in US, they were born in Kyrgyzstan, I think. And so I made a really simple research, something that everybody probably does today, whatever is the subject. So I put on Google like Chechen identity, and I just have a look at the pictures. And there's a lot of like, you know, this terrorist wars, et cetera, et cetera. So I was thinking, this is not really Chechnya. I mean, this is something that the media is pulling out. And how Chechen people will react to this image, especially if they're not in Chechnya, they've never been in their own country. So this was basically the idea. So I decided to depict Chechnya in a sort of like super neutral identity and the way that Kadyrov is actually shaping this identity.
I wonder, David, sort of on that point, it's quite difficult. We sort of talk to photojournalists who have been reporting sort of from the front line, as it were, looking at conflict in a very immediate way. And the sort of conflicts that are depicted in your pictures and that we see sort of witness in Chechnya are very long term. It's not a state of active war. It's something that's gone on for decades. Does that make it more interesting, or is it more of a challenge for a photographer to document a conflict that has that kind of character? As you alluded to a minute ago, it's very international. There are people who feel very strongly about it who've maybe never even been to Chechnya. Yeah. Does it make it more difficult to capture what that conflict looks like?
Well, it is more difficult, in my opinion, just because there's nothing really happening. I mean, when you go to a real conflict, you have action. I've done this as well in the past. I mean, I really appreciate, and it's a great job, what a lot of photographers does in like news, hot news. In my work, I'm not interested so much anymore because I think we have a lot of information about it. We have a mass information about these kind of pictures. So I'm more intrigued, and I think it's more challenging to try to go a little bit deeper.
Well, David Monteleone, thank you very much for joining us. The show is called Spasibo. It's on at the Saatchi Gallery on the King's Road in London until the 3rd of November.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards. In a few minutes, we'll be hearing about a fascinating new film about this man. It's Edwin Collins with A Girl Like You.
That was Girl Like You by Edwin Collins. In 2005, Edwin experienced a stroke, effectively deleting his mind's contents and leaving him able to utter two phrases. One, Grace Maxwell, the name of his wife, and the other, The Possibilities Are Endless, the name of a new film about Edwin's experience.
Wherever you are, if this is too much, it's okay. But if you think there's a way back from this, fight hard. Please fight hard.
Who are you doing it for, really? You, aren't you?
Yeah.
I must get better. I must experience the world, whatever that is.
A clip there from the film's trailer, and it's less a rock doc, more of a story of memory, identity and love. The Possibilities Are Endless is an intimate tale about one man's mind and its journey of rediscovery. Its directors, Ed Lovelace and James Hall, are with us now in the studio. Chaps, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Let's start off with where the idea came from, first of all. Were you fans of Edwin's work and you kind of wanted to see him get back on stage, or what was the genesis of it?
I mean, we were always fans after Girl Like You came out. That was released when we were like, you know, teens on dance floors. And then, always like followed his work. We weren't kind of like mad fans, but just, always like kind of respected him. And then, heard about his stroke and then didn't hear anything for about 5 or 6 years. And then he released that album, Losing Sleep, that was his first record post-stroke.
Yeah.
And we were just kind of shocked when we heard it, just because we always say it has that kind of like youthful energy. It's as if it's like a first record, not a record from someone who's just been like through loads of trauma. And all the lyrics seemed so different from his old lyrics. We started to like ask questions of like, was he the same guy? What had happened in those 6 years? Like, if you like look at an artist and they disappear for half a decade and something like really life-changing happens to them, do they create similar work, and what does that work say about them? So we wrote a letter to his wife, Grace, and just said, can we come in and meet you guys and see whether we might be able to do something together, just because we were so excited about Edwin telling his story, basically.
I think we were just really, really interested in meeting him and meeting Grace and really trying to try and start something. At that stage, we weren't sure it was even a film, really. We knew that there was an interesting story there, but we weren't sure what it was. So we kind of went in with open minds, and fortunately we all got on really well, had a lot of tea and biscuits in their studio in London. And then from there we started going back doing these audio interviews with Edwin. We came back about, I think it was about 2.5 years, wasn't it? We were doing audio interviews.
Oh,
and
wow.
That worked almost as research, really, as we were kind of trying to, like, you know, dig into his memories and see what he could remember and see if he could actually tell his story, really. We weren't sure going in if, because when we first met him, he was like quite stilted still with his speech, and his fluency wasn't at the level it is now. And we found that sitting with everyone around him, people would naturally want to jump in and finish the sentences or prompt words or memories for him. And we were interested in just trying to get him on his own, get him trying to tell his story. So the interviews were just myself, Ed, and him in a room.
So Ed, tell us a little bit about watching this recovery then at first hand. I mean, that's an extraordinary sort of intimate experience almost. You're charting this progress, I guess, slow at times and maybe with great leaps at others. What was that like? Did you sort of come to realise that you were making a piece that was as much almost like a sort of medical documentary as much as something about a guy and his art?
Well, I mean, we were really excited when we realised that for some of these questions we were asking him, he was like delving into places of his memory that he'd never been before. So it's so, like, you know, usually with documentaries, it's like people are recounting events that have already happened and everyone's probably even read about them. And it's like quite often they can be like quite predictable in that sense. But when we were interviewing Edwin and we'd ask him about these like big themes about love or about creativity and about family, we could see by the expression on his face that he'd never delved into like that kind of like place for answers. So that felt so exciting. And basically after like 3 or 4 months, we said to Grace, we're like, look, is it cool that we're doing this? Like, how does everyone feel about it? When he leaves the studio, what does he say to you? Is he like, does he like the experience and does he want to keep on going? And Grace was like, this has become like an integral part of his actual recovery, just because you guys are giving him the space and time that no one is usually given. We'd sit there for an hour and just let him just kind of like try and figure out his answer to a question. That was our atmosphere, like no pressure, just let's just see what happens. So Grace and Edwin were like, yeah, you've got to keep on doing it because he's improving just by the process of making the film. So there were, once we kind of knew that, it suddenly we had like a responsibility to them to make sure that we like fulfilled our promise to try and make the film. But yeah, I mean, it's less like medical really. We really wanted to avoid making a film like about stroke as per se, and more just about like one guy's story. Obviously it just so happens that he has these disabilities, but Edwin's so much more than a man with a disability. And like, he's like, the first thing he always says is like, yeah, I'm not a victim. Like, I mean, he's still like the coolest dude. He's still wittier than us, wittier than anyone else we know really. And the funny thing is, when Edwin's trying to finish a sentence, quite often in our heads we'd be thinking, I guess he's talking about this, and you'd be inclined to help him. But if you gave him the time and space, his answer was always so much more than our predictions. He could, you know, that he still had that kind of like really like amazing visual way of using language, even though it was that like stilted.
And the mood of the film, as we said in the preface, is sort of very intense. It's an unusually put together film. It's not just it's not a straight story. It's I think shot, is it Helmsdale?
Yeah,
is where a lot of it's shot, and it's. It looks like the possibilities are endless. It's these big skies, these wide beaches and all the rest of it. Is that somewhere where he grew up, or is that somewhere where you sort of took him to kind of prompt a recovery and prompt getting the words into his head and out of his mouth?
Helmsdale has been a part of his family history for a long time. He used to go there when he was a kid all the time, and Edmund and Grace are actually moving back up there now, so they've had a family home there for years and years. And that place was actually always really important to him, and in the first interviews that we were doing with him, he'd always talk about these memories when he was younger, and it would always be about the nature of the place. Helmsdale, it's a beautiful countryside, and he described it to us in such a, I guess, a magical way almost, that we had this picture of it in our heads that was, you know, this kind of dreamlike place. So yeah, Helmsdale's always been really important to him, and for the film...
Yeah, well, like, I think because Grace had, like, whispered kind of tales of Helmsdale into, like, Edwin's ear when he was in his coma... Edwin seemed to wake up just with this like image in his head of this place. He kind of wasn't quite sure where it was and what it was called, but he knew he had to get back there. So for us, that was like this amazing kind of like...
And it gives you a weird like story arc as well, doesn't it? It allows you to go to places as filmmakers visually and in terms of a narrative that you wouldn't if you were doing a straight story. You know?
Yeah. And what's so cool about Edwin is like, you make a film about a musician, or you make a film about anyone who's an artist, they're trying to protect their own art and their own image of themselves. Obviously, we've made a lot of like films about musicians before in the past, and obviously like we've got our idea of what we want the film to be, but they've got their own idea of what their image is. So it's such a hard kind of like battle for you to get on the same page. The great thing about Edwin is that Edwin and Grace were just like, they kind of, I think they realized that what we were trying to make was something creative and was going to be in its own right an idea, not like the Edwin Collins film, but much more like a film about memory and identity and more than an A to Z of Edwin's backstory.
Yeah.
So they basically just let us, and once they'd seen like a kind of little test at the beginning of that, I think they got excited about what it could be, and they basically just like gave us the freedom, which is pretty crazy that they weren't kind of precious about anything. They knew that we're going to go away and create something without boundaries. I think that's the reason why it is probably quite ambitious and quite different, because like, how often do you get an artist who's willing to let someone else go and like recreate the image of their life
and see
like,
their frailty as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think Edwin and Grace knew from day one that we would only ever make a film that's like really like true to them, and we would never, obviously it was important that in the film you realize what Edwin's been through, but at the same time Edwin never wants to be seen, like I said, as like someone who's like, you know, he's been like a victim or something.
Yeah.
He's such like a hero, and he's been such a trailblazer pre-stroke and post-stroke that we always wanted to make a film that was like true to his personality and true to Edwin and Grace's relationship.
And I guess there's music is at the heart of all of this. Talk to us a little bit, James, about the score then and the music that's used in the film. What sort of opportunity or challenge did that present, given all of this complexity about the history of Edwin with his music and his experiences?
Well, we always knew that we wanted Edwin to do the score. At the beginning, we weren't sure he could actually, you know, make that sort of music, because what we were looking for was a certain tone and mood to it, and it creates kind of like its own identity as well. The music, it works against the landscapes, and you get this a real sense of like mood that was really important. And Edwin was, obviously, we'd heard all the albums, we love what he does, we just weren't sure if he could create this kind of ambient sound score. We all agreed, yeah, obviously, that he was going to do it. And then one day he called us up and said, hey, I think I've got something here. So Ed and I went into the studio, you know, slightly cautious, like, okay, cool, what if, you know, Edwin Collins, our hero, what if he plays it? And we're like, oh, it's just not quite right. Yeah. And what was crazy is that we hadn't actually shown them much of the film at that point either. So this was Edwin just kind of going on, I guess, like intuiting what we wanted, kind of knowing what we'd been shooting, but not really having seen a big chunk of the film at all. So yeah, we went in there, and then he played this, it was about a 12-minute sort of soundscape that was just the most beautiful, like, it just like completely blew us away. This, and that moment, Ed and I were just sitting there in the studio, 12 minutes of complete silence, obviously this music building, it has the strangest sounds in it, and it was just, suddenly we could see the film, really. So that was like a big moment for us. We were like, okay, now we've got like a movie. Like, we almost have to make sure the film lives up to that sound score in places. So no, that was great. And yeah, I mean, Edwin's genius truly, yeah, knows no bounds. But within the film as well, when we were using Edwin's older tracks, using his back catalogue, we wanted to make sure that we weren't just using it as context. You know, we wanted to use the songs so that it would be relevant to where he was at in his recovery. So, for instance, there's a moment in the song where, in the film, sorry, a moment in the film where he remembers that he wrote Rip It Up, but it comes at a time when it's like he needs himself singing back to him to say, you know, you need to rip it up and start again. So we tried to focus on using music in a slightly different way to a conventional music documentary.
A stroke? Convulsing? Scary stuff. What happened to me? I'm struggling to come to terms with who I am.
There's a great sense of sort of interiority about that, isn't there? The sounds and stuff. This is obviously Edwin talking over some of the soundscapes that he's created. It's a kind of bewildering mix, isn't it, to kind of get your head around. Presumably that helps the audience get right into the, well, I presume the intention is to get into the head of Edwin Collins.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like you were saying before, I think the whole ambition of the film was to like not tell it from someone else's perspective. You know, like when you see documentaries, quite often you're like, right, here's an event, and let's get 10 different people to tell us what happened so we can create like a true picture of what happened. But with this film, we were just like, we just want to know whether Edwin could tell his own story. And once he proved to himself and to us that he could do that, right, when no one else needs to say anything. So like, we really wanted it to be, yeah, exactly that, exists from the inside out. So many of his like memories and stuff, really wanted to try and get the audience to feel what it was like to wake up in your own kind of subconscious, confused and disorientated, but also surrounded by so much like beauty. Like, so much of the film is inspired, like the way we shot it was because Edwin would talk about these memories with such like amazing imagery and passion and emotion to them that, yeah, we really wanted to like, Edwin kind of set the bar for how like ambitious it had to be because he was so like visual with his language.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. It's fascinating just in the telling of it, and the film obviously is a proper intense ride. That was Ed Lovelace and James Hall talking to us about their film The Possibilities Are Endless, and the movie is on a preview tour and released on iTunes from October 20th and is out on general release from November the 7th. Up next, we enter the realm of the rich.
Nothing compares to a handmade wooden yacht, so say Bodrum's boat builders. Monocle travels to the Turkish port city to film the century-old skills still at the heart of the country's boat-making business.
The wooden gullets, they have soul. I don't want to say the other ones don't have any soul, but it's different. We fall in love with the wooden boats, and we give our soul when we build the boats. It's like an art, every small piece done by hand.
Boat Builders of Bodrum, a cinematic portrait, now playing on monocle.com.
Thank you.
The super rich have forever captured the popular imagination, and from oligarchs to philanthropists to sheikhs, royals and 21st century tech giants, the wealthy have, of course, shaped world history for centuries.
In a new book, The Rich, From Slaves to Superyachts, a 2,000-year history, writer and broadcaster John Kampfner tells the story of the rise and rise of the world's wealthy over the past two millennia. He spoke to Monocle's Thomas Lewis and began by explaining how he came to the idea of tracing the story of the rich.
I was a foreign correspondent in the early mid-90s in Moscow, and that was the time of the great upheaval, the end of communism. But it was also a time when, as a foreigner, and you had access to special shops under the old Soviet communist system, you could impress Russians, those that were allowed to come into your apartment, with your cans of Heineken and your cans of Carlsberg, and they thought this was incredibly exotic. Fast forward 5 years later, and Russians would be in London inviting you to dine with them at Gordon Ramsay or at somewhere else and being incredibly dismissive and sort of buying bottles and magnums of Krug and behaving in a way that has become sort of symptomatic of the new rich and the oligarch tendency. So what I was trying to do with this book is really to trace back through history the manifestation of the super rich. And by super rich, I don't mean people who are just generally comfortable, who are fortunate enough to go on a couple of nice foreign holidays and have a car and the usual trappings of what used to be regarded as a middle class or upper middle class lifestyle. I'm talking about people who wouldn't dream of going on a commercial airliner or wouldn't dream of going on a yacht that didn't have a helipad. And trying to trace the historical precedents for that, I look at 10 historical figures, some of them very mainstream, some of them slightly more obscure deliberately, and really try and trace what are the tendencies among those people going back 2,000 years and to what extent is what we're going through now consistent with history or to what extent are we living through something completely different?
And to what extent, therefore, are we living through something completely different? Where's the beginning point, then, in your book? If we use the private jet or the helipad as the image today, 2,000 years ago, if we'll pick that number, the super rich were the super powerful too, and that was political power, maybe in a different way the super rich yield today. Is that a fair assessment?
It is very fair, and it's exactly then as it is now. It is financial power, which begets political power. Then it begets a curious fascination. Once you've made shed loads of money, some people just build themselves palaces and hide inside them behind their high security gates. And that's consistent again with history and just try to shut themselves off from the world. Others begin to think, well, I've got to do more with this and I need status, and that means all the trappings of office or social respectability, being at the right place at the right time. It's also reputation. Super rich have always been obsessed with their reputation. How will their peers look on them? But more importantly, how will history look upon them? And what's both intriguing but also quite depressing is actually it doesn't really matter how you make your money. You can be as dodgy as you like, or you can be as entrepreneurial and innovative as you like, or you can inherit it, or it could be a combination of any of those and more. It doesn't really matter. Once you've made the money, then you assemble this army of assistants around you. And again, it doesn't really change over time. You have your financial advisors, you have your political advisors, and you have your lawyers or aides in different eras. And they're all designed to consolidate and then expand your reputation. And that's exactly what happens. So you start in the Roman times. My first character is the intriguing Marcus Licinius Crassus, who came up with this wonderful scam of training his slaves to become firefighters, history's first fire station. And what happened was, surprise, surprise, all these buildings in Rome are just suddenly caught fire. His guys would come straight round and say to the hapless locals, we'll put out your fire, just sign under this form here and we'll relocate you outside the city. In so doing, they pretty much took over all the property and all the land in central Rome. He then put all the politicians, the senators, in these properties at cut price rents. So they were completely beholden to him. So he then became one of the great, there was a triumvirate, one of the great three leaders of this period in the Roman Republic. So this guy Crassus, having found this sort of housing scam, becomes a great politician. But then the real sort of kudos in those days wasn't having a super yacht, obviously. It wasn't bankrolling art. It was paying for armies and then leading armies. So he led the Roman army into various adventures and then ultimately misadventures in Asia. And legend has it that his enemies poured molten gold down his throat. And so he came to, pardon the pun, a sticky end.
It's quite then, a way to go, as they say.
And then I think the character, lots of people always talk about the robber barons, and I have a chapter on them, particularly on Andrew Carnegie and his curious but really interesting small book called The Gospel of Wealth, which is
and
really...
And there's a lovely, on the back of the dust jacket, yeah, there's a really lovely cartoon of Carnegie clad in a kilt with Kentucky at his feet and this big bag of dollars kind of with him showering it over the states. It's really sort of rather a wonderful image from the time.
That's right. And he was a really fascinating guy, a self-made man from a poor family in Dunfermline. The Industrial Revolution, a bit like the technological revolution of our present day, deprived a lot of people of jobs. So what a lot of people then did was go to America, to the new lands, in search of anything, really, not in search of wealth, but in search of just the modicum of a decent life. And Carnegie very quickly saw one opportunity after another, the great sort of rags-to-riches story, and then he and people like Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan and others devised this great scam whereby they divvied up the three most important elements of the emerging American economy. That was the steel mills, the railroads, and the banks. And they developed these cartels. So they and their friends all became mind-bogglingly rich. I mean, that sort of London oligarch Mayfair territory of now. I think what was so interesting about Carnegie, and particularly he, but the others too, wasn't so much how they made their money and the sort of bling nature of how they spent it. It was his philosophy. It's imbued with a sort of Darwinian sense of there must be a reason why I have become so incredibly rich. I must have some sort of great genetic powers. And a lot of these super rich over time, then and now, because they mix almost exclusively with each other, they reinforce each other in their own convictions about their own greatness. But the most interesting part of Carnegie is the idea that great men become incredibly rich, but great men die poor. It's not good enough just to give some of your money away, bits and pieces, here and there, and it's not good enough to give it away in your will. What you should do, once you have amassed this money, because you have the sense of greatness and superiority, sort of noblesse oblige imbued in you, from that point, when you've reached the top, is that you should start very systematically giving away your money.
And the motives for that, the money that Carnegie amassed brings tears to the eyes, but as does the amount of money he gave away. And that naturally brings to the mind figures today like the Bill Gateses, the Warren Buffetts, yeah, the Bill Clintons even, yeah, with their foundation. Yeah. What are the motives then that link them? You discuss this idea of building reputation, of trying to sort of canonise or maybe even sanctify kind of the image of kind of the person or the path that they led or the path that they try to put forth. What would you say links them? And is there, therefore, a cynicism, which you do hint at, when people of great wealth do pass on their cash to those who never made it to those levels of wealth?
As with so many things, there is a mixed motive. If you have made your money to a degree through sharp practice and anti-competitiveness and monopolistic practices and everything else, you do need to launder or to cleanse your reputation. I mean, just by its very nature, you want to, once you have everything, then that in and of itself is not good enough. You need to then really focus on your reputation. And a lot of them do. And a lot of them then genuinely become driven by this approach. I mean, the Gates Foundation is very interesting. They have done, as we all know, a lot of work in Africa and in developing countries, particularly tackling malaria and HIV/AIDS. And they do work with NGOs and with government bodies, of course. But instilled in some of these private sector foundations is very much the view that they can spend the money better than government organizations. And it's partly due to the fact that It goes back to this Carnegie Gospel of Wealth Darwinian notion that I am rich. I became rich because I have special genes and special brains. And so therefore, just as I know better than most how to make money, so I know better than most how to spend that money. And they really do genuinely believe it. You can also be more cynical or skeptical and say it's a way of justifying tax avoidance. Because one of the main reasons, if you look at all the trouble Google's in and all of the Silicon Valley and basic and American corporate giants who all have their money offshore, and you avoid paying the kind of corporation tax that lesser companies pay, then you've got all this stash of cash. And rather than just leave it there, you almost have to justify to yourself emotionally the reason why you have this stash of cash. So therefore, that's the way of spending it better.
That was Monocle's Thomas Lewis there talking to John Kampfner, author of The Rich, From Slaves to Superyachts, a 2,000-year history. Well, that brings us, Rob, to the end of this edition of the Monocle Weekly. Fascinating to talk to Ed and James about their documentary. Well, I almost feel like I shouldn't call it a music documentary about Edwin Collins. It seems like it's so much more than that.
It's got a sort of amazing, a very powerful but sort of effervescent quality, that film. And they were charming blokes. It was really nice to meet two people that were obviously sort of moved by making the film, but are quite definite about how they kind of wanted that film to turn out. And I don't know, they seem like very talented chaps. Weirdly, they made the top grossing music documentary of all time about Katy Perry, a completely other ballpark.
It's extraordinary.
Subject matter.
Well, to be able to clearly turn your hand, you know, with alacrity to such different sort of targets within the sort of musical firmament.
Exactly.
So that's all. From me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Robert Bound.
It's goodbye.
For tuning in.